Church I grew up in, if I had a good time during service, I got a spanking when I got home. So I love it that we can come to church and we can laugh. How many of you know the Bible says laughing is like taking medicine?
Yes.
And think about it. It don't cost you nothing. You don't have to fuss about the copay. You just laugh and you feel better about things. It's a joy to me that I've got to do this. I've told your pastors privately and I've said it publicly too, how much I appreciate them being willing to do this. I love God. I love God's people. And I love our country. And it's heartbreaking to me that I look at the way us from our generation, and certainly those who have come after, how our educational system has really cherry-picked what they want to teach. How many of you know if you take the truth out,
yeah,
it can only be by definition a lie?
Right.
If it's anything other than the truth. And as I pointed out each of the weeks, when we talk about history, if you break that down, it's his story. God has been the keeper of mankind and the earth. You know, the Bible tells us that the earth is going to reflect his glory, that's why we're here. So I have believed that from the beginning, there is a such thing as divine providence. That is God intervening in the affairs of mankind. I don't think there's any question that's what America is. That's what I've talked about these previous 3 weeks, is the providential impact on our nation of God. From the very, very beginning, from our very genesis, our DNA, as I've pointed out each week. Everybody wants to know about DNA. Listen, if you want to know the DNA of this country, it's not hard to find. You just won't find it at any university. You just won't find it if you read History Channel, or you watch History Channel, or if you listen to CNN or whatever. They're not going to tell you, because they have very carefully removed many of the references and in many cases the actual words of our founding fathers. And so that's what I've endeavored to do, is try to tell you not my opinion of history, but let the people tell you themselves in their own words. So we've heard from George Washington. We've heard from Daniel Webster. I haven't talked too much about him, but I was thinking, you know, Daniel Webster really considered the father of American education, gave us the dictionary, as you know, the first spelling book, the blueback speller it was called. Daniel Webster said, you can't educate without the Bible. He said, the most important thing we can do is teach young people the Bible. I reminded you that when the first school was built in Massachusetts, of all places, in 1647, they said, the great deceiver, Satan, has worked hard to keep mankind ignorant of God's holy word and the knowledge of his son, Jesus Christ. And that is why our first and foremost purpose, that every little area that has more than 50 families will have a public school where people can be taught to read and write so they can know God and know his scriptures. How many of you know you'll never be told that in school, even though it was churches who founded schools? You'll never be told that in university, even though the first 108 universities that were founded in the United States, 106 of them founded by churches. Let me hear you say, imagine that. This is every Ivy League school. We've been through all that. So I'm trying to kind of go back and resurface some of those areas to build upon that in this, our final week. We talked last week about Abraham Lincoln. What an incredible individual. This is my opinion, but I'm bold in it. I believe Abraham Lincoln is the most pivotal character in the entirety of U.S. history. And I'll tell you why. I think he's the greatest president that this nation's ever had. Here's why. If he isn't the greatest president in the United States, he will be the last president of the United States. His entire term was completely overshadowed by people hating one another, wanting to kill, literally brothers wanting to kill brothers. 5 weeks, think about what a big deal it is to be inaugurated president. 5 weeks after he's inaugurated president, South Carolina secedes from the Union. And almost daily then he gets reports of now this state has seceded, now that state has seceded. He's hearing constant complaints. How many of you here enjoy being with somebody that complains a lot? None of you. Well, how many of you? That's all people did, was complained about it. The media was on his case. Everybody was on his case. And then, like I said, 5 weeks after, South Carolina doesn't just secede. They start firing on Fort Sumter. And so his entire presidency is marked by trouble, tumult. He never has a moment of peace. And yet this guy stands for me. And I believe if you look at his life, he stands for any of us as the most pivotal character in preserving what we know as the United, operative word, United States of America. Because but for him, this nation is divided. God used him. He is a providential character in our history because God used him to do two incredible things. One was to eradicate slavery. He is, after all, the one who signs the Emancipation Proclamation. He is the one who signs the 13th Amendment, which outlaws slavery. And most importantly, he not only eradicates slavery, but simultaneously preserves the Union. And then 5 days after Robert E. Lee surrenders, Abraham Lincoln is shot. So literally, his entire presidency, from beginning to its virtual end, was hell. Hardship, difficulty. And I told you last week, here's a guy who grew up with a very atheistic view, made fun of preachers, made fun of God, and yet it was his having to deal with death. His mother's death when he's 9 years old, his sister's death, his closest friend's death, 3 sons that die, 2 of them before they reach 10 years of age. He's familiar with death and hardship. And it was these hardships, it was these tragedies, it was these terrible things that happened to him that actually God allowed to use to refine him. How many of you know I believe the Lord allow whatever it takes in your life to bring you to your knees? How many of you have lived that? Go on ahead, all of you raise your hand. You all have. None of you were born a Christian. It took trouble and hardship. And here's a guy who is familiar with that. Well familiar with that. And so what I wanted you to understand was is sort of what leads up to Lincoln being president. He takes over a nation that's at the very cusp of a civil war, which is the worst kind of war. But it was a necessary war. I believe God allowed the civil war. I believe the Civil War was a consequence to a nation's sin. We want to look at it, and that this was part of the problem the Union had those first 2 years. Everyone in the Union looked as the Civil War as the problem of what the Confederacy was doing with slavery. And yet, even if you thought that way, you say, well, then if that's true, if God's on the side of the Union because they want to get rid of slavery, why are they losing every war? Every battle that took place the first 2 years of the Civil War, they're losing. And what really makes it crazy is they're losing when they have their opposition outnumbered 2, sometimes 3 to 1. They're better armed, they're better trained, they're better prepared, they got shoes. How many of you recognize over your lifetime that shoes are a valuable commodity? They've got all the things. They got gunpowder. If you're going to fight a war, you have to have gunpowder. The South doesn't have that. That's why they have to make an alliance with France to get gunpowder shipped over here, lest they don't have any way to fire their guns. They don't have a way to fire their cannons. And yet the Union is losing. Why? Well, because of two key figures, Robert E. Lee and Thomas Stonewall Jackson. I told you, Robert E. Lee, incredibly, look at your neighbors and say, incredibly. Incredibly, at the exact same time, has on his desk a request from Abraham Lincoln to be the commander-in-chief of the Union Army in this upcoming Civil War. And next to that, he has a letter from Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederate States of America, asking him to be the commander-in-chief of the Confederate Army. Now, if you listen to historians today and all the people who are championing pulling down Robert E. Lee statues and renaming cities and streets and everything that gives any honor to him, if you listen to them, they'll tell you, well, the reason that he chose to go with the Confederacy was because he's pro-slavery, he's against anybody of color, he was a prototypical man of the South of that age. And if you want to listen to that, that's fine, but it's not the truth. And so what I want to talk to you about briefly, because you can't talk about Abraham Lincoln without talking about Robert E. Lee. They are two pivotal characters on either side of this whole deal. So let's talk about Robert E. Lee. Why did Robert E. Lee go with the Confederacy? Why did he choose that letter over this one? Well, you have to know his past. You have to know his DNA. Robert E. Lee was a Virginian. Robert E. Lee believed that Virginia was the critical colony in the formation of what we know as the United States. I believe that too. Patrick Henry, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Virginians. Furthermore, he believes that Virginia is going to be key because of his own family. his father, who was a great hero of the Revolutionary War, a cavalryman that helped several times kind of save Washington when they were in the middle of trouble. Henry Light Horse Lee was the name of his dad. He's a Revolutionary War hero, later becomes the governor of Virginia. In his own family, that is Robert E. Lee's family, there's a governor, two senators, two congressmen, an attorney general, and four men who signed the Declaration of Independence. So from his perspective, Virginia and his ties that go back to Virginia, that's where his allegiance is. Robert E. Lee didn't look at it as I'm going with the North or I'm going with the South. He looked at it as I'm going with my country. Those are his exact words, in fact. When he wrote to Lincoln and deferred and resisted this request to be the commander, he said, I don't look at slavery as a right thing. He said, there is no right place for slavery. There is no civilization that could endorse slavery and not be considered evil. But he said, I can't imagine the circumstance, nor will I ever entertain the idea of drawing my weapon against my country, Virginia. And so he said, if Virginia stays with the Union, President Lincoln, I'm with the Union. But he says, if Virginia secedes, I got to go with my country. I could not imagine drawing my sword against my own country. And so he said, what'll happen is my fate and perhaps my life will be given for my country, Virginia. Now here's the last thing you may not know of why Robert E. Lee ends up going with the Confederacy. How many of you know who you marry impacts your life? Hallelujah. How many of you here prayed about who you're going to marry? How many of you here wish you had? No, don't raise your hand. sorry, just a little humor there. So Robert E. Lee marries, drum roll. Remember, he goes back to Virginia. He believes that's where his connection is. George Washington's second marriage, he marries a woman. She has children from a previous marriage. He adopts those children and loves them as his own. Anybody here, an adoptive parent, or as they say in our culture, stepdad or stepmom, if you've ever done that, raise your hand. Okay, then you know what we're talking about here is a love of choice. I have two sons, neither came from my seed. And one of the things I learned that adoption teaches you, how many about the Bible tells us that unless we're adopted, we can't cry, Abba, Father, right? Well, a lot of people only know adoption from one side. You've been adopted. Say that with me. I've been adopted. Say this. I know who my daddy is. I've been adopted. That's right. And praise God, you understand that side of adoption. But there is another side to that coin. And that is the one who's not the adoptee, but is the adoptor. If you're the adoptor, then what you realize is this is a love I choose. I'm not obligated because, well, you know, I got your mother pregnant, and blah, 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 and that's how this goes. This is a love of choice. I choose to be your father. That's what George Washington did. And eventually, his grandson, through adoption, so reveres him, so honors him, he decides he's going to build a mansion that is going to stand as a great building tribute to George Washington. And he envisions that inside that building, he'll have all of these collectible things that had to do with George Washington's life. Does anybody know what the name of that building was? It's called Arlington. And Arlington was the home that was built, not to be a home, but really to be, in many ways, almost like something where we keep all these artifacts and things? A museum. Supposed to be almost like a museum to George Washington. But he finally realizes this thing needs to be preserved. Here comes Robert E. Lee. He starts dating the daughter of that man who built that. Ultimately marries her. Her name's Mary. And so now Robert E. Lee becomes friends with that man and then says, listen, your vision that you have, I'm going to see that through. When that man dies, he becomes executor of his will and carries that out. And Arlington becomes the family home to Robert and Mary Lee for 30 years. It's just across the Potomac from Washington, D.C. You can literally sit and look at everything. If you were there today, how many of you have been to Arlington Cemetery? I mean, you just look across the river, you can see all of Washington, D.C., can't you? It's just right there. That was his home. So understand this. When he takes agreement to be the head of the Confederate Army, he realizes, I'm giving up my home. In fact, 3 days after he signs that letter, he and his family move out of Arlington, never, let me hear you say never.
Never.
Never to return. What happens to it? Well, the Union Army recognizes, if we don't go over there and take captive Arlington, man, the Confederates could use that. They could set up, they could put cannons there, they could do. And so they say, well, we got to figure out a way to take it, but we got to do it legally. And so finally what happened was Congress enacted a law that said that the taxes that were to be paid for every property of that time during the Civil War had to be paid in person by the property owner. Now, what are the chances that Robert E. Lee or his wife are going to go walking up and paying the tax? He is, after all, the commander-in-chief of what they perceive to be their enemy. So obviously they don't go, they don't pay the taxes. She tries to send the taxes through one of her workers, and they said, it has to be paid by you or your husband. And so the government, the Union government, takes over control of Arlington. And so they start thinking, what would be the ultimate way we could thumb our nose at Robert E. Lee and what he's done, leading the Confederacy against us? And they said, what if we decided to bury our Union dead in his yard? And they said, you know what? Let's not only bury him in his yard, let's bury him right up next to the foundation of the home. That way he'll never be used. If you've been to Arlington Cemetery, two presidents buried there, most notably John F. Kennedy. I believe Taft is the other president that's buried there. It is considered today, I mean, the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier is there. I think you would have to agree that's probably our most hallowed ground in the United States. And how did it become that? A spite to Robert E. Lee and his family. It became and remains today. And by the way, in fairness, Confederate dead were buried there too as the war progressed. So we look at this thing, and Robert E. Lee becomes the commander of the Confederate Army. He's smart because he knows people. How many of you know if you can be a great leader, you got to understand people? You got to like people. I've met a few people in ministry who didn't like people, and I'm like, you're out of field here, aren't you? How many of you heard people say today, stay in your lane, bro? This ain't your lane. You know, there's so many people. I remember we would host guest ministers when I was in staff ministry, and they'd say, you know, brother won't have anything to do with the people until he comes in and teaches, and as soon as he's done, there should be a vehicle to whisk him off. And I'm like, don't you love people? If you haven't figured this out by me by now, I love people. I do. I love people. I love everybody. And so Robert E. Lee understood people. And you got to remember, he went to school with all the commanders of the Union Army. He knows all of them personally. He knew Grant personally. They were both great heroes in the Mexican War. I mean, they fought alongside each other. And here they become adversaries at the end. He ends up surrendering to Grant. They actually reminisce about the good old days at his surrender. But the thing about Lee was he understood these guys. And he knew what their propensities to what their personalities were like. He knew that's going to affect how they govern. That's going to affect how they general. And so he defeats them all. Lincoln goes through 6 different generals in 2 years. Can't ever find anybody to bring him a victory. I told you when Grant brought him his first victory, everybody had, you know, spoke ill of Ulysses S. Grant because he was a drunk. You don't want him. He's a drunk. You know, half the time he don't know where he is. But he brings Abraham Lincoln news of his first victory. Do you remember what I told you Lincoln said? He said, find out what whiskey Grant's drinking and send a case of that to all my other generals. I think that's awesome. And so Lincoln realizes we got trouble here. We've got twice and three times sometimes the forces. They're better trained. They're better equipped. And we're still losing. And we're supposed to be fighting on the right side of this. Why? How many of you have ever been so desperate you actually sought God?
Yeah, sure.
I told you my favorite Abraham Lincoln quote is he said, many times I have found that I've been driven to my knees because I had nowhere else to go. And he said, this was one of those times. And he got on his knees and he started seeking God. And he said, the Lord spoke to him and said, the problem isn't just the sins of the Confederacy. It's the sin of a nation. The Union is guilty as well. because you've tried to compromise slavery. You've tried to work along with this, and it was wrong. And so in 1863, say this, incredibly, he issues a proclamation of humiliation, prayer, and fasting. I read it to you last week. In a nutshell, here's what he says. He says, look, we've enjoyed now, since 1776 to 1863, 90 years of success, prosperity. We've been blessed. God has blessed our efforts. We defeated, after all, the superpower of the world in Great Britain. And now we've forgotten God. And we somehow think we've done this all ourselves. Don't you think somebody could say that about America today? We think that somehow through our own wisdom we've pulled this off, that we're the best, we're the greatest. Yeah. He said, the fact is we forgot God. And now we're at trouble and we don't know what to do. We're losing constantly. He said, for this reason, I'm calling the entire nation. Now understand, when he says nation, he's talking about the Union. He doesn't have any authority over the Confederacy. He's talking about the people who all think they're godly and doing the right thing. How many of you have ever known somebody that their greatest sin was that they were self-righteous?
Yes.
And that's what they had here. And he realized that. How many of you know 2 Chronicles 7:14 says, if my people called by my name will do what? Humble themselves and seek my face. That's what President Lincoln called the entire nation to. And this is why he is so critical. And this is why his leadership and his desire to serve God is critical. Because 2 days, say 48 hours, 2 days after he issues that proclamation and calls for the entirety of the Union to hit their knees and seek God, again, the most, I believe, let me just say this to you. I believe the Civil War is the most pivotal period in the entire history of the United States. Okay? Those 4 years, I believe, are the most pivotal that we've ever faced, because we're not fighting an enemy that's overseas, vis-a-vis World War I, World War II, Vietnam, Korea, you name it. We're fighting ourselves. The war here is within. As Lincoln quoted Jesus saying, a nation that's divided against itself cannot stand. So we're fighting ourselves. So I believe that's the most pivotal thing that's taken place in the history of our nation. But now I want to tell you what I believe is the most pivotal event of that most pivotal period. And that is what happened 48 hours after Abraham Lincoln calls the entire Union to a time of fasting and prayer. Because 48 hours after he does, Thomas Stonewall Jackson is killed. Why is that significant? Because for 2 years, Robert E. Lee thinks it up, Stonewall Jackson makes it happen. And in fact, it happens at Chancellorsville, the Battle of Chancellorsville, which is considered the greatest victory Thomas Jackson ever had. His greatest tactical day of victory was that particular day. And later that night he decided, let's do some reconnaissance for the next day's victory. He would have always sent spies to do that. Thomas Stonewall Jackson was a man that loved God. They called him the praying general. The media said of him, he seems more interested in handing out Bibles and leading his soldiers to Jesus than he does winning a war. They said the same thing of Robert E. Lee. Both of them were constantly on their face praying. And both of them to the man said this, for us it's not about who wins, it's about the will of God being done. Now understand, these are guys fighting a war daily, but both of them to the man said, this isn't about winning or losing, this is about the will of God. When Lee was asked constantly about slavery, he said, it's wrong. He said, if I knew that it would avert the war, we ought to give every slave total freedom today if we could avert a war. But it didn't. I read to you last week that Abraham Lincoln, 2 years in, is going, what's up with this? He said, we're both praying to the same God. God can't bless one thing and curse it at the same time. There's got to be reason. He said, I finally realized, this is Lincoln talking, he said, I finally realized God must have a purpose beyond winning and losing. God must have a purpose that goes past the I'm for the blue and not for the gray. He said, otherwise, this war could have been over in a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. He said, it could be over today. But he said, he continues to will for it to continue. Why? How many of you know that God forgives us? He's merciful and gracious. But how many of you learned there's still consequence to your sin? Wave your hand and say, I know that's right. Yeah, consequence. Even when we're forgiven, and many times the consequence remains for quite a season. What's the value of consequence? How many of you know consequence will teach you a lesson when nothing else does? When you have the residual impact of your sin and your disobedience, when you have to live with that day by day, that tends to be a detriment to you doing it again. Amen? I believe that's the reason the Lord allowed that war. Everybody thought it'd be over in 6 weeks. Everybody on both sides. Union boys were telling their wives, I'll be back in 6 weeks. We're going to whoop them rebels. Confederate boys are telling their wives, I'll be back in 6 weeks. We're going to whoop the Yankees. But now they're 2 years in, and every battle's been fought here in the South, and the Union's losing them all. And Lincoln calls the nation to prayer. And what happens? The man who couldn't be beat, Stonewall Jackson, is shot. By who? His own men. Say it with me. Providence. He or Lee one had to be taken out in order to preserve the Union. As long as they're both there, they're not going to lose. They continue to win. And so Jackson is killed by his own men. Providence. That was God intervening in the affairs of the United States. And the cool thing about Stonewall, he was fine with it. Remember how he got his name? When there's bullets whizzing around everywhere, he's riding his horse. He's not hiding behind a wall. He's up here riding his horse. It's like he's riding back and forth in front of, you know, it's like a shooting gallery. Y'all can't kill me, nah, 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 nah. And when people asked him, how is it that you're able to do that? He said, because I know God. He said, God alone knows the time of my death. And he says, as a consequence, I'm as comfortable sitting in this saddle in battle as I am sleeping in my bed at home. He said, if all men knew God like I do, they could be equally as brave. I think that's rich. I told you that when he was shot, he didn't die for 9 days. When he came to, he looked and he saw every surgeon in the Confederate Army had all milling around his bed. He said, I see by all of y'all that you're concerned about me. He said, but I want to tell you, you don't need to be. Because it is, if it's God's will for me to die, I'm ready to go. I'm happy to go. And he did. He died. And that was the beginning of the end for the Confederacy. You see, just 2 weeks after he dies, Confederate forces are looking for shoes. Again, shoes are a great commodity in times of peace. They're even more valuable in times of war. And somebody tells them, hey, there's some shoes up here at a little crossroads town. They look at the map. What is the name of that town? Gettysburg. Is it okay if we go and get? Yeah, go and check it out. And so a group of Confederate cavalry go to do that. And they run into the Union Army. How does that happen? Because Robert E. Lee doesn't have his eyes. What? He doesn't have his eyes? Well, if you're a general, how many of you know you're not right in the middle of the battle? You're back here watching, but you can't see everything that's taking place. So what are the eyes of a general during the Civil War? The cavalry. The cavalry is mounted. It can move quickly. They're on horses. He had the finest cavalry commander, a man named Jeb Stuart. Real name, John Ewell Brown Stuart. But because he always signed J.E.B. Stuart, everybody called him Jeb. Jeb Stuart, where was he from? Drum roll, Virginia. And he is fearless in battle. And he's been the eyes of the general for 2 years. And the general's always given him his head. My wife and I love horses. If you want to ride a horse, if they've been trained, if they've been bred to do a thing, we say, give him his head. Don't sit there and hold the reins so tight he can't do anything. Loosen the reins up. Give him his head and do what you've trained him. Do what he's been bred to do. That was the genius of Robert E. Lee. Whoever he had that was under his command, he gave them their head and let them do the thing. He didn't micromanage everything we were doing. And so he told Jeb Stuart, be my eyes. I'm blind without you. Be my eyes. Jeb Stuart delighted in that. Jeb Stuart furthermore delighted in being able to go out and secure wagons of armaments. Remember, they're underprepared relative to the Union Army. So he would go and sometimes steal 40, 50, 60 wagons full of armaments, of implements, of all kind of stuff. And so it was just before Gettysburg. He had been gone for days. Lee didn't know where he was. Jeb really didn't even know where Lee was. But what he knew was he had found 120, say 120, 120 wagons full of supplies that he got from the Union. Well, it takes some time when you've got horses to get all those back. And so as a consequence, he isn't there for that first battle, that first day. Gettysburg was 3 days of battles. He wasn't there for the first day. So Robert E. Lee's blind. He would never have bumped into the Union Army. He would have never allowed that to happen. He'd had his eyes. Say it again, Providence. Providence, God's got Jeb out there riding around, 120 wagons full of stuff. He thinks he's doing great things. He doesn't realize him going off and being, in many ways, AWOL from his duty is serving God's purpose. Because now you have two armies that bump into each other at this little unknown town of Gettysburg. And Robert E. Lee's never one to run away. In fact, for 2 years, he's been thumping the Union. So he's like, let's do this. But he doesn't have Stonewall Jackson there to make his plan take place. And I told you the man who's taking his place, named Richard Ewell, is a guy who's his whole life been known throughout his time at the military college and throughout his time when he was serving. He's kind of hesitant. Well, y'all remember the character on, remember Floyd on the Andy Griffith Show? You know, y'all, Floyd always looks like he's going to hyperventilate before he gives an answer to anything. I never met Richard Ewell, obviously, but I kind of envision a guy like that. So he's not sure. And they have a whole day of fighting, and basically General Lee says to him, take that hill. If you know anything about Civil War battles, it was all about the ground. You wanted the high ground. If you got the high ground, you can see the enemy. You always have the prime place to do battle. And so he said, take that hill. But it was tough. And from Ewell's perspective, man, my men are tired. Let's just rest. We'll fight another day. And when he comes back that first day, when the Confederacy had thumped the Union like they always did, the first day of Battle of Gettysburg, when he comes back, General Lee says, did you take that hill? Well, imagine Floyd. And he said, well, listen, General Ewell, what do you hear? What did I tell you he heard? He heard spades up on that mountain digging rifle pits. Because he said, you know what? Because you decided your men were too tired and you couldn't see it through to take that hill today, tomorrow, your men are going to die trying to take that hill, which now your enemy is going to be dug in and ready. You see, this is why it's so pivotal Stonewall Jackson isn't there. Jackson would have took that hill. There never would have been day two and day three of Gettysburg. It'd have been a one-day battle. You'd hardly have heard about it because the big news would have been 2-3 days later, Robert E. Lee goes riding into Washington, D.C. And now we don't have a United States anymore. The media that had been clamoring for 2 years, just let them do their own thing. We don't have to have a union. We don't have to have a United States. We could have two different countries. That would have been a very real possibility. But God allowed Jackson to be removed. His replacement doesn't do what he's supposed to do. Thank the Lord. Because he doesn't do what he's supposed to do, you and I are living in this free country we have today. But what does happen is there's two more days of bloody battle. The bloodiest battle in the history of the Civil War. 50,000 casualties in 3 days. Now here's what's wild. Remember I told you, Lee, Jackson, Grant, all the generals on both sides, they were all trained the same way. They were all trained under the Napoleonic approach to war. And in the Napoleonic approach, you want to take both flanks of your enemy and attack that. And what you think he'll do is in order to protect his flanks, you don't want people getting around behind you, right? That's what it means, a flanking maneuver. When Lee attacked the left and the right of the Union position, and so in his mind, what is the Union going to do? Where are they going to take men from the middle and fortify out here? And so that's what happens the first 2 days. And so on the third day, Robert E. Lee thinks, well, we've attacked his left position. We haven't been able to take the hill. We attacked his right position. We haven't been able to take Little Round Top. How many of you here saw the movie Gettysburg? See, that's what I was afraid of. I'm reminded of that hymn, No Not One. How many of you have ever seen the hymn, No Not One? This is my command to you. I imagine it's on Netflix. If you have that, we don't have Hollywood Video. And remember the days of VCRs? These young people are going, what's a VCR? Google that. Where you could go rent movies. If you can, watch the movie Gettysburg. Because a wonderful job of showing you providential characters. I don't have time to get into it, but there's another guy named Joshua Chamberlain on the Union who is a providential character in preserving the right side over here, Little Round Top. In fact, he's able to defend that hill when his men run out of bullets. They were coming and they had a few Confederate prisoners, but they were coming back to him and saying, General, we're out of bullets. He goes, don't say that loud. We don't want them to know that. When he had no more bullets, he told all of his men to put their bayonets on the end of the thing and do a charge down the mountain. And they overran the Confederate forces with no bullets. Who wins a war with no bullets? He did. Later becomes the president of Bowdoin College and serves 3 terms as governor of Maine. He's a big time dude. And so there's providential things happening, keeping Robert E. Lee, thwarting his success over here, thwarting his success over here. So by the third day, he thinks they've sent men over here to fill that in. They've sent men over here. So now where's the Union Army the weakest? Middle. In the middle. And so on the third day, he orders what you know of as Pickett's Charge. How many of you heard of Pickett's Charge? Well, here's the deal. Before Pickett's Charge ever takes place, Robert E. Lee orders, I believe he had 110 cannons. He told all of them, I want you to aim at that little copse of trees right there, because that copse of trees right there is the Union command position. He said, I want you to aim everything you have at those trees. For 45 minutes, the finest Confederate gunners unloaded everything they had right there. I've read many historians have said they believe it's the loudest sound ever heard on planet Earth, those 45 minutes of those cannons going off. How many of you here have ever been to a Civil War reenactment? You got to hear the cannons go off? You've been to Chickamauga, maybe?
I don't know. I don't remember.
Well, if you, my wife would take me every year, because Chickamauga, by the way, was always the weekend of my birthday, and so a lot of times she's done that for my birthday, and we go, and they have Civil War era cannon that they fire, blanks, of course, but even standing behind them, concussion is so great, it'll cave your chest in, and that's one gun firing. This was like 110 that fired for 45 minutes continuously. And these are his finest gunners. Lee already thinks that's the weakest place in his position. Now I have weakened it further with all of these cannon fire. Say this with me, Providence. What he doesn't know is God has directed every one of those cannons so that all of it's gone right over the head of the Union force. None of it hit where it was supposed to. Lee doesn't know that. He thinks we've softened to their position. And so he now orders the largest infantry charge in the history of mankind. He sends an entire section of his army across an open field. Anybody here been to Gettysburg? Have you seen there where Pickett's Charge took place? You see this huge open field that these men marched across thinking they're marching into a completely decimated area, when in fact, none of those Union guns over there have even been touched. And when those guns begin to fire, it's a turkey. You heard the phrase fish in a barrel, like shooting fish in a barrel. And I'm thinking, who has ever shot fish in a barrel? That's boredom to the max. I don't know, let's shoot some fish in a barrel. You came in. That's sort of what's happening here, because it didn't matter where they shot, they're going to get somebody. And it makes me weep when I think about this. For Civil War soldiers, the worst possible thing was to be shot in the back. Because if you're shot in the back, it looks like you're a deserter. And so many of those Confederate soldiers marching across that field finally realized this is hopeless. And they were ordered to retreat. But they walked backwards so as not to bear the stigma of being shot in the back and being perceived as less than brave, being a deserter. And Robert E. Lee goes riding out to meet him as those men are coming back. And many of them tell the story. He said, it's my fault, men. It's my fault. I'm so sorry. It's my fault. And see, here's the thing. They called him Old Uncle Lee. Or Uncle Bobby Lee. They all considered him like their grandpa. They loved him. For 2 years, they've been undefeated. If he thought it up, they did it. Here's the first time of abject failure. But why? Say it, Providence. Jackson isn't there. Now, you may think, well, that's it. Pickett's Charge, many historians today that write, I just want to thump them because they all want to say, well, this was proof that Lee didn't know what he was doing. What he did was textbook. From the standpoint of how Napoleon fought, a man who took all of Europe, he's done it exactly to the T. What gets lost And what many people never know is what happened simultaneously to Pickett's charge. Pickett's charge were men on foot. Lee said, I got one more move. One time I was serving the Lord in a place, and the Lord spoke to me. He said, I'm going to take you out to where you can see other things because you've seen this and thought this is my only move. He said, I've got moves you haven't seen yet.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to get you out. When he called me to travel ministry, he said, I'm going to take you over here and I'm going to take you over there so you can see I move other ways than just what you know. Well, Robert E. Lee had some moves they still hadn't seen. And so on the third day, say at the same time, he sent Pickett across this open field. He sends Jeb Stuart, his cavalry guy, who remember, he's back now. He sends him, if I'm not mistaken, he had 5,000 mounted cavalry to ride around the extreme back of the Union Army. And when they went riding around the back, they met no resistance. And even though Pickett's charge was a complete failure, Robert E. Lee would have still won Gettysburg, but for a guy named George Armstrong Custer. How many of you have heard of him? Yeah, and what you've been told about him was he's the most pompous guy in the world. He got what was coming to him when he fought the Indians. Well, the fact of the matter is, George Armstrong Custer is part of why you're sitting here today in a free nation. Because George, if you think Jeb Stuart was a bad dude on a horse, there was no badder dude than George Armstrong Custer. Say 10. 10 horses shot out from under him during the Civil War.
Wow.
His favorite words he would always say to his men from Michigan, come on, you Wolverines, we've got them now. We've caught them napping. He's always outmanned. He's always outnumbered in his cavalry charges, but he wins every time he routs them. So here's George Custer. He's not been given any orders by General Meade, who's over the Union forces. He's not been told, be vigilant, do this. Basically, what he was told was, we've got a big infantry battle going on right now. If y'all want to, we're going to put you back here in the safest place, and y'all just take it easy in the back. And so there's George Custer back there with about 500 cavalry when Jeb Stuart with 5,000 cavalry comes around the back, and Custer sees him. Now, I've already told you enough about Custer. You ought to be able to figure, what did he do? Did he say, let's run for help? He charged.
Yeah, charged.
He charged. And when he did, he split Jeb Stuart's forces in half, and they retreated. Providence. Even though Pickett's charge was a complete disaster, what Lee had done with Jeb Stuart around the back would have been a success but for George Custer. And that is why, on the day Robert E. Lee signs his surrender at Appomattox Courthouse in 1865, General Sherman, who was General Grant's second in command, took the desk that Lee signed his surrender on and gave it to George Custer's wife, Libby. He said, no man in this army is as responsible for Robert E. Lee's surrender as your husband. Take this desk. Were you told that about George Custer? No. No, everybody likes to pile on and tell you what a dumb guy he was and what stupid things he did. And some of this stuff was. That's another day's study. But Custer was key. Custer was key to preserving our union. Speaking of our union, here's a little known fact that I think is pretty cool. When you think of the Civil War, they say the first shots that were fired were at Fort Sumter. That's true. But the first real battle that took place at the first battle of Bull Run, or sometimes it's called Manassas, in Virginia. It took place on a guy named Wilmer McClendon's farm. Remember, Abraham Lincoln gives a decree that Union soldiers are to go and invade the South. Since they've seceded, they're hostile, invade the South. So they invade the homeland of these people. And this whole first battle is fought. Imagine if you're Wilmer McClendon and they fight this battle out there in your cotton field. That's literally what happened. The war started in his backyard. Eventually, during the war, he lives in Virginia. Everything in Virginia is overtaken. The Union Army overtakes his home, runs him off. And they make his home a command post. And later make it a courthouse. And later, Robert E. Lee rides in and signs a surrender in that man's parlor. And that's why it's said that the Civil War started in his kitchen and ended in his parlor. Wow. I think that's pretty cool. Little known fact that I think is pretty awesome. When you start finding out tidbits of history like this, this is what makes it fun to learn. This is what I wish somebody had done for me when I was sitting there as a student, to give me some aspect where I go, well, that's cool. I'm going to let you do it. Look at your name and say, that's cool. I think even if you don't think it's cool, say it is. Say it again. That's cool. And so it is, Robert E. Lee surrenders. And 5 days after he surrenders, Abraham Lincoln thinks, I finally got what I've been yearning for 4 years. He's been reelected. His first term is not yet up. Everybody do this. I know that's what Lincoln must have done. After 4 years of tumult, after 4 years of being pummeled by the press, 4 years of being pummeled by Robert E. Lee, 4 years of getting one negative report after another, finally, they've defeated Robert E. Lee. He has signed his surrender. There were many people that were advisors to Lincoln that said, kill him! Kill him! Stone him! Probably church people. Where did you get an idea like that? Well, you remember the story in the Bible, don't you? Stoner, she was caught in the act of adultery. How many know it's one thing to be an adulteress, but to be caught in the act? Stoner, she's probably thinking, yeah, stone me. And they were all ready to do that when Jesus comes walking up. Hey, wait a minute, what's going on? Oh, shoot, blah, 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 blah. And he's like, well, I agree, that is the law. But you know, let's just don't do this willy-nilly. Why, Eddie, if you threw that, you're liable to hit Bobby over here. And he hadn't done nothing wrong. Let's make this in an organized fashion. In fact, let's do this. Let's put you all in a night organized line. And let's do it. I got it. Let's have who of you have not sinned. Why don't you throw the first stone? I love that. And what happened? Everybody put your hands up to yours. What did everybody hear? Clunk. 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 Stones falling. People walking off. There were people who came to Abraham Lincoln and said, you know what we ought to do with Robert E. Lee? Hang him! You know what we ought to do with Stonewall Jackson? Hang him! Well, he's already dead. Well, hang him anyhow! I mean, people were angry. They wanted to inflict as much pain and retribution as they could on the Confederacy. But Abraham Lincoln, he who prays, he who vilified God for the first part of his life, but now realize he's my source. He who speaks at the establishment of the Gettysburg Cemetery, gives in my money the greatest speech ever made. How many of you here have read the Gettysburg Address? If you haven't, you need to. 10 sentences, 272 words. The man who spoke before him, former president of Harvard, senator, great orator, speaks 2 hours. 2 hours. I look at some of y'all after 20 minutes and you're some people awake wonderfully refreshed after church. Oh, that was glorious. I made it eat. Can you imagine somebody speaking 2 hours? He speaks 2 hours, and when he's done, Abraham Lincoln walks up. There's no microphones. He doesn't have a bullhorn. I've read accounts of the day. They said he walked up, reached into his pocket, and pulled out 2 pieces of paper and set it up here, put his spectacles on, glanced at his speech, which he had written the night before, folds them up, puts in his pocket, and gives the whole speech from memory. He didn't have speech writers. He didn't have teleprompters. He didn't have someone going, President, please look over here. Oh, I'm sorry, I was miles away. None of that. They won't put that on the tape. They'll take that off, I'm certain of it. No, Lincoln gives the speech he wrote. Can I read it to you? I'm not really asking. I'm going to. A lot of you raised your hand and said you've heard it, but if you haven't, you need to. I reiterate, 272 words, 10 sentences, 3 minutes tops. He was done speaking. He'd sat down before most of the people knew he'd even started. Wait, what happened then? Well, that was the president. There were newspaper writers, media of the day, who said it's the goofiest, most ridiculous thing we've ever heard. Never should have even given him a time up there. It emerges today, most people agree, the greatest speech ever given. And what's the consequence? What's the circumstance? Well, he's here dedicating a cemetery where men have died. And how is it he can speak in 3 minutes at that kind of a sincere issue? Here's what I'm going to tell you. He didn't need 2 hours. Because here's a guy who's known death from the time he's 9 years old. Here's a man that's buried his mama, buried his sister, buried his first love, buried 3 of his children, has watched defeat after defeat after defeat, death after death after death, and he's the man in charge? Here's a guy who understands death. Here's a guy who understands grave. He don't need 2 hours to speak to it. He can go straight to the heart of the matter. Why? Because here's a guy from his own words who said, I've met the one who overcame death and the grave. Amen. Forgive me. I told y'all the first week, this is something never seen before in public. My wife says, you're too vain. Put them on and read it. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation. A nation that was conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we're engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation that's so conceived and so dedicated can endure for long. We are met on a great battlefield of that very war. We've come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that very nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. Brave men who died here, who struggled here, have consecrated it far above our power to either add or detract. Isn't that rich? He says, the world will little note nor long remember what we say here. That was wrong, Abraham. But it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, to be rather dedicated here to the unfinished work. Remember, this is just 2 years into the war. To the unfinished work for which they fought here and have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task that's remaining before us. That from these honored dead, we can take increased devotion to the cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. That we here can highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, but that this nation under God, he added that phrase the night before, that this nation under God shall have a rebirth of freedom, and that the government of the people, by the people, and for the people, shall not perish. That's as good as it gets, y'all. That is as good as it gets. And so this man, who I submit to you is the most pivotal character in the entire history of our nation, dedicates that cemetery. It'd be wonderful if everybody had said, that's so powerful, let's just stop the shooting now. It goes on 2 more years. Finally, Lee surrenders. 5 days later, Abraham Lincoln, do it again, exhale. Thinking that's where he's at. Boy, Mary, we've made it through all this. Just look at all we've been through. He says, I tell you what, you're going to spend the night together. We're going to do something fun. You want to go to the theater? Yeah. He says, I tell you what, we'll take a buggy ride this afternoon before we go. But I've got a couple of cabinet meetings I've got to go to. In the last hours of his life, he met first with General Grant, who had given him victory, honored him, patted him on the back. Then he met with the rest of his cabinet, many of whom were there to figure out ways to make things worse for the Confederacy. He said, ain't no way. He said, here's what we're going to do. Those are our brothers. We're a union again. They've surrendered. No more fighting. He said, I want you to treat all of their leaders with integrity and respect. And he said, I want to put in place aid to every Confederate state so they can be built back up and made strong again. That tells you his character. The last thing he did officially as president of the United States, they came to him with a young man who was a deserter. Now, you may know in times of war, if you deserted, if you were caught, they killed you. Firing squad. This young boy had deserted. Only now the war's over. And classic Abraham Lincoln looked at that young man and he said, you know what, son? I believe you'll be of more value to this country above ground than below it. Pardon him. Last thing he did as president was pardon someone else of their sins. Then he went home and made good on his promise. He took Mary on a buggy ride. Open buggy. No secret service. Open buggy. Riding through Washington. Many people saw him and saw something they'd rarely ever seen. They were publicly showing affection. He was holding her hand. She said, Abraham, what will the press think that you're holding my hand in public? He said, they're not going to think anything of it. They're going to know I love you. And speaking of loving her, if you've read anything about, how many of you here have ever met somebody that was hard to love? I mean, clearly it's none of you here, but how many of you have met someone? Sure. I think we all have encountered. Well, he married one. I'm just telling you. She was straight up hard. She was so jealous everywhere he go. She even cussed out generals in his army, their wives, because she felt they were too close to her husband. I mean, she was over the top. She was a, how many of you have known somebody that's emotional? You know, baby, I love you today. I love our life together. And then that night, I hate you. She was kind of like that. And so nobody had seen him show her public affection like this, but he's holding her hand. And she said all that day he talked about what we're going to do now that the war is over. He said, I've got some plans for us. I want us to go travel. He said, I'm so tired. I just want to get away. And so finally she said, we got to get back. We got to go to the play. It was going to be a comedy called Our American Cousin. It's going to be at the Ford's Theater right there. And so they go home. They get dressed up. They invited several other prominent couples, among them General Grant and his wife. They all politely declined because, to be forthright with you, they didn't really want to spend a night with her. I'm being real. And so two kind of underlings in society, a man and his wife, they went with them. They got to the play late. The play was already going. They sat in the presidential box. Theater seats 1,600 people. So they're seated. It's actually over here on the left of the stage. The box for the president's probably 10 foot off the ground over here. They're seated up there. President Lincoln said, look, when I come in, because he knew customarily whenever he'd go in the room, they'd play All Hail to the King, or the, what is it? Hail to the Chief, thank you, sorry. And so he said, I don't want to do that. But the conductor of the orchestra, remember back in those days, you didn't have tape. These are actual live orchestras. He sees Lincoln being seated up. Stop the play. Time out. And they play Hail to the Chief. And the whole place goes nuts applauding. Because remember, Lee's just signed his surrender 5 days ago. And everybody's so thrilled to see President Lincoln. He stands up and he waves all of them. He sits back down. They continue. He stands up again, takes his hat off and waves at him. Sits down in his rocking chair. They had a rocking chair for him up there. And the play continues. They're watching the play. He's not overly interested in it. And so he's talking to his wife kind of playfully like he has throughout the day. He's so happy. Exhale again. That's how he feels. It's all good. I mean, people say today it's all good when it isn't all good. But for him, it was as close to good as he'd experienced in 4 years of being the president. Exhale again. It's all good. We're at a play. I don't even like plays, but I'm here. He didn't even care what the play was. It's a comedy. But he's talking to her throughout it, trying to just whisper. He again holds her hand. She says, what are they going to think? Abraham, you're holding my hand again. He says, they're just going to think I love you. And he leans over to her and he says, you know, I was thinking, when this is over, I don't want us to go back to Springfield. I want us to go abroad. I want to travel. He said, in fact, I want to go to the Holy Land. He said, there's no place I'd rather see than where our Savior walked. As he sang those words, unbeknownst to him or anyone else, there's a figure that's walking up the steps to where the president's box is. You think, how could that figure just get up there? Because that figure is an actor who regularly performs at that theater. In fact, it had the lead in a play at that same theater just 3 weeks previous. In fact, an actor who gets his mail. That theater is considered his home where he receives his mail. And earlier that day, he'd gone to pick up his mail. And all the mail's addressed to who? John Wilkes Booth. He picks up his mail there at the theater and hears someone talking. He doesn't talk to them, he just listens. What he hears is, President Lincoln's going to be here this evening. And John Wilkes Booth has been a Confederate sympathizer the entire war. He's so angry at what's happened. He's so angry that Lee has surrendered. He's so angry at Abraham Lincoln. And now he hears Lincoln's going to be there that night. He hatches a plot. They're going to kill not just Lincoln, but several other people simultaneously. I won't get into all of that. That's another night. But his job is to kill Lincoln. And so that afternoon, he walks up those steps to the presidential box, which he's well familiar with, and he takes a board and puts right there so that later, when he gets inside, he can put that board across the door and it can't be opened. He then goes into the next box. There's the first place you go into the presidential box, and there's a wooden wall, and then you go into another area that's actually where the president's seating. He goes into that wall and takes his pocket knife and bores out a hole. So that later that night, when the president and his wife are sitting there in their box, he's waiting. Now, he's well familiar with this play. He knows what line comes when. He knows it's a comedy, and he knows what line is the biggest laugh line in the whole play. And so he sneaks in. He opens that door to the president's box. He puts the board in place where nobody can find him or get to him. He walks in and peers through that hole that he had bored out in the wood days before and sees exactly what he expected to see, the back of the president's head. Takes out his .44 caliber Derringer pistol and then waits for that big laugh line in the play. What's incredible is at the same time he's waiting for that line, President Lincoln is leaning over to Mary and he's just said, there's no place I'd rather see than where my Savior walked. His last words, for I truly want to see the Holy Land. The laugh line in the play occurs. Booth shoots him behind his left ear. He doesn't fall out of his chair. He just slumps over, sitting in the rocker. Everyone hears the shot, but nobody knows what it is. In fact, many of the actors in the play and many of the people there who are familiar with the play think, maybe this is a part, this is something that's supposed to happen. It's staged or something. Nobody can figure. And then Wilkes Booth swings out of the president's box down into the stage and says, the Confederacy has been avenged. Only when he swings out and lands on the stage, his foot gets hung in the bunting, the red, white, and blue things you see. It gets hung there, his spurs do. And when he falls, he breaks his ankle. He is able to get away. He's got horses waiting for him. He's made arrangements so he can make a quick getaway. He thinks he's going to be loved by the Confederacy. As it turns out, he's the most hunted man, and later, he's captured and killed. But now we got a dead president. Not dead right away. They take him across the street to a boarding house. They lay him in a bed there. They ask, is there a surgeon in the house? Anybody? People come up. They realize this is mortal. There's nothing to be done. They take him across the street. He dies at 7 o'clock the next morning. And he's buried. How many of you here have been to the Abraham Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C.? For all those that tell you that there's a separation of church and state? I will tell you that's a lie. How many of you have been told there's a separation of church and state? Why, you all have. Why have you all been told? You've not been told anything else I taught you about, but you've been told that, haven't you? You know why? Because you're supposed to know that. You're supposed to believe something that isn't even true. You won't find separation of church and state anywhere in the Constitution. What you will find is an amendment that says, this Congress shall make no law regarding the establishment of a religion. Do you remember when I told you the 13 colonies, the southern colonies, their whole perspective was the Episcopal approach, the man. You have a pastor who's the guy. Then you had the middle colonies who said, no, you don't vest it all in one. You need a plurality of leadership. You need to have a board of guys. And that's how we do church government. And then you had up in the northeast colonies, New England, they all said, no, it isn't one guy. It isn't 8 or 10 guys. Everybody has a voice. And so it was when people were coming and clamoring to our founding fathers, people from the southern colonies, people from the mid colonies, people from the northern colonies, saying, now which one of these forms of church government are we going to have for our national religion? They finally realized it don't matter which one of these we choose, we're going to tick somebody off, right? In fact, allow me to read one last thing to you. Say this with me, Supreme Court. A justice of the Supreme Court was asked to address this issue. And so when you're told repeatedly there's a separation of church and state, or the establishment clause, as they like to call it, I want you to hear what a justice of the Supreme Court said about that, which I'm convinced is in my notes, but bear with me. Let me hear y'all say, keep looking, Kim. Say, you'll find it. Yes, I just did. Justice Joseph Story. Remember, what I've endeavored to do throughout this thing is not tell you my opinion. I did tell you my opinion is Abraham Lincoln's the guy. Short of that, everything I've told you about has been in their own words. Don't ever take what History Channel or PBS or anybody else does. It's supposed to be the truth. Listen to people in their own words. I've let you hear what Lincoln said. I let you hear the prayers of George Washington. I let you hear the pilgrims, all the different things. Now you're going to hear from the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court at this very time that the First Amendment is made. Here's what he said. He said, in some states, Episcopalians are the predominant sect. In others, Presbyterians. So now that's the southern colonies and the mid-colonies. He said, in others, it's the Congregationalists, the New England colonies. He said, in still others, you've got Quakers. He said it would be impossible that there would not be perpetual strife and jealousy if the national government was to establish one of these as the national church. Thus, the whole power of the subject of religion will be left to the states. And that's why you have the First Amendment that says, this Congress shall make no law regarding the establishment of a religion. You've been told today that means there's no place for Christianity in government. What a joke. Christianity was the government.
Yes, yes, yes.
Every colony, every school, every university, virtually every founding father loved God. And are the reason we have a union preserved today. And it's the reason it is, in fact, his story. How many of you know all the people today who are teaching universities and teaching a lie? Just like you and I are going to stand before the great throne of heaven and give an account. And every knee will bow, and every tongue will confess, Jesus is Lord. Amen. What I believe God's looking for today is this generation's Abraham Lincoln. Yes, even this generation's Stonewall Jackson, the praying general. By the way, he decreed that every Sunday they would hold church services, and every Confederate soldier was to go. I'll tell you one last story. Look at your neighbor and say, this is the last one. The last story. He comes riding up to a camp on a Sunday. He sees the captain sitting there smoking a pipe. This is the general. Rides up and the captain sees him and stands up. And he says, Captain, here's what he called him. Are divine services going on right now? Of course he knew they were. He ordered them. How many of you here know somebody that they make points to you by asking questions? My wife is the queen of it. Are these your socks? Yeah. So he wants to know, are divine services going on right now? To which the captain, smoking a pipe, says, hello, General. How you doing? Jackson never acknowledged him. He asked him again, are divine services going on right now? He says, I don't know, sir. He then says to him, where's your colonel? He says, General, I'll take you to him right now. And so they go walk into the colonel's tent, and when they get there, Jackson stops and says, oh, I see divine services are going on. He said, Captain, won't you promise me that from now on, every time divine services are going on, that you'll be there? Yes, sir, General. And he ran to services. That was Stonewall Jackson. In those 2 years when they were winning all the battle, the Confederate Army had a revival. 150,000 men got born again. See, God used, either that's the reason this thing didn't last 6 weeks or 8 weeks. There was a consequence to a nation's sin. But God used even that season for lives to be changed for eternity. Today, that's what I think our nation's in desperate need of. I asked this young man, what's your name? Say it again.
Wyatt.
He had on a Lee shirt. I said, you go to Lee? Yep. I said, what are you studying? What'd you say? Criminal justice. And what did I say? I said, we need you. We need some people in our criminal justice system who know the truth. Who know the truth. Who know the truth. How many of you know people can't give you a drink of something they've never had? People can't take you somewhere they've never been. We have to have leadership. Here's a principle that's been true from day one and will be true till the Lord returns. You can't rise above your leadership. I'll tell you two things in your life that will be difficult to ever overcome. Number one, your leadership. If you don't have leadership that's a 10, you'll never be anything but a 7 or an 8. You can't eclipse your leadership. Other thing that'll be difficult to ever overcome, confession of your own mouth.
Yes.
Amen? How many know you can't walk in healing if all that comes out of your mouth is, I'm about to die. My back's killing me. Right? How many know you can't walk in financial blessings if all you ever confess is, we're about to go under. This is, you know, we're going to die broke. We're going to lose everything. Guard your mouth. Bow your heads, close your eyes. Thank God for Abraham Lincoln. Thank God for George Washington. Thank God for Patrick Henry. Thank God for those three cowboys who caught Benedict Arnold trying to commit treason and give West Point to the British Army. Thank God that Washington could cross the Delaware. Thank God for snowstorms that hid his travel across that river and caught the British by surprise. Thank God that Stonewall Jackson loved God and from his own mouth said, God and God alone holds the appointment of my death. Thank God for Abraham Lincoln not giving up when he was so tempted to commit suicide. Thank God that when he was encountering one death after another, that everybody that was dear to him was dying. What he came across from that was, I need to pray. I need to seek God. I realize I got nowhere else to go. And thank God he taught an entire nation that. That when we got great trouble, when we got great trouble, when we got great trouble, we need to pray. Because there must be a reason. We need to humble ourselves. He told the entire nation, we need to confess our sins to the only one who can forgive. And he emerges today, for my money, the key individual in the preservation of this nation. But that's been 170 years ago. This nation needs preserving today. We need some standard bearers today. We need some men and some women who aren't ashamed of the gospel, who hold the banner high and run fast. And so if you've got anything out of what I've said in these 4 weeks, what I hope you'll get is God doesn't pick the smartest people. God doesn't rarely picks the most intelligent or the most talented. He often picks people who say, I could never do that. Moses, I could never do that. God says, you're my man. Because he said, you know what? In your weakness, my strength's made perfect. And I'll equip you. And you'll be victorious. You'll be more than a conqueror. You may think, I could never do that. I'm a nobody. Nobody knows me. Nobody cares about me. If you're with God, you're always in the majority. You'll always be victorious. You may have enemies rise up against you in one way. They're going to run away from you in seven because you have a covenant with God. That's what preserved this nation, was it was made with a covenant with the living God. Father, I just speak the blessings of Deuteronomy 28 over this country. That if we can turn to you, all these blessings shall come upon us and overtake us. Or as we've learned, you never bless disobedience. There's curses as well. Lord, help us. Help us, O God. Forgive us of our sins. Cleanse our hearts before you, O God. Let us be able to come boldly under your throne of grace. That our lives personally can be healed, our families personally can be healed, and our nation can be healed. Lord, I pray you'd move on the hearts of men and women today. Raise up leaders in these universities. Raise up men like Wyatt, who'll stand up and have a backbone and not be ashamed. Who'll speak the truth and do it in love. Raise up moms and dads who'll speak out against abortion. Raise up moms and dads who'll speak out against drag time story hour. Raise up moms and dads who'll speak out against those who say there's no place for prayer in schools. There's no place for prayer in government. There would be no school. There would be no government but for prayer. Wake up your church, I pray, Father. Why don't you all just raise your hands, everybody, and ask him how you could be used to accomplish his purpose in this little community. God may never call you to leave Bradley County, but he's called you here. You grow where you're planted. And I like to think of this as the last Mayberry on earth, but hey, we got trouble here too. You drive around in this city, you've seen it like I have. You've seen the homeless. You've seen the drug abusers. You've seen the people that are hurting. We have the answer. Let God use you. Ask God to use you to be a giver of life and hope to people who have none. Father, I just speak blessings over Pastor Mark and Cleveland Christian Fellowship. Lord, I thank you, O God, that the same way I feel about the United States that I feel about Cleveland Christian Fellowship, that its greatest days can be the days ahead. Father, return to him 30, 60, even 100-fold the kindness he's shown me by giving me this platform. Return it to him, I pray, megafold. I just pray for increase in blessing for this church in Jesus' name. Everybody say it is done. I want you to do one last thing. I want you all to point at an empty pew in here. You can pick the one. You can point at more than one if you want to. And I want you to make this confession with me. God using me to fill that pew. Pick another one. Point at it. Say it again. God using me to fill that pew. How many know that's how God works? That's not your pastor's job. How many of you know that all of us have been called? How many of you know in Genesis, everything God blessed, he said the same thing to it. Be fruitful and multiply. The only time he ever cursed anything in nature was a fig tree. Why did he curse it? No fruit. I'll let you connect the dots. Come on, brother.
Glory to God. Glory to God. A couple of weeks ago, I was with a table full of pastors, and I said,